Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, everybody, dear colleagues. It's my pleasure to welcome you to join one of our weekly neurology episodes. In fact, week three of the epilepsy episodes. My name is Bernhard Steinhoff. And I have the pleasure to serve as a co-chair of the EAN scientific panel epilepsy right now. The topic of today is molecular genetics in epilepsy, what should I know? And it is with really great pleasure to welcome my friend and colleague, Professor Holger Lerche from Tübingen, who is the expert of today. Holger, would you just briefly introduce yourself to the audience?
Yes, thank you, Bernhard, for the kind introduction. I'm Professor of Neurology and Epileptology here in Tübingen. We have a department system here with shared responsibilities. And I'm, from my research part, an expert in physiology and genetics. And we are dealing with genetic epilepsies and looking for new diseases, disease mechanisms, and so on. And this will be the topic of today.
Great. Now, the topic is molecular genetics and epilepsy. And a lot of neurologists are a little bit intimidated about possibly not knowing everything and not knowing the modern developments we have in the molecular genetic field and epileptology. And that's what we are discussing today. So for a starter, what would you say, what is the role, the clinically relevant role of molecular genetics in epilepsy nowadays, Holger?
So I think it's mainly in pediatric epilepsy that this really plays a role in clinical routine diagnostics. Yeah, so it's part of early diagnosis in severe epilepsies that have a presumed genetic origin. So many of these developmental and epileptic encephalopathies. So severe epilepsies of title with developmental defects and so on. And there are four things that are really important. This is having a diagnosis, having the possibility to say something about prognosis, to enable genetic counseling, and to modify therapy. I mean, I think these are the four topics that we should talk about.
Now, if I see an outpatient, 15 years old, suffering from a difficult to treat epilepsy, what's the next step if I want to counsel that patient appropriately in the genetic aspect?
Yeah, the next, so if it's not just a focal severe epilepsy with hippocampal sclerosis or so, and there is a presumed genetic origin, and most of these patients with these severe epilepsies and developmental delay have de novo variants, so there is not a family history, although this is genetic, yeah, so this has to be known. And therefore, it would make sense to do a genetic diagnosis, yeah, and to collaborate with either a commercial lab that is doing this or a human genetics department in one of the universities that are offering this. And usually, at least we in Germany have now the possibility to do exome diagnostics. So that means that we sequence the whole coding sequence of the patient. So every gene will be sequenced. And this has two advantages. One is that the one gene diagnostics anyway is out of what we do today because it's too expensive and we are looking at we would have to look at too many genes until we find the diagnosis, since many different genes can all cause the same syndrome. Yeah, so if we, for example, look at Otohara syndrome or West syndrome, there are 5, 6, 7 or more genes that are able to cause this epilepsy syndrome. So therefore, at least a panel diagnostic should be done. We in Germany have the possibility, and in most European countries, it's also possible to do exomes. It's not more expensive. And you have not only the possibility to look at all the genes, but you can also look in 2 or 3 years again on that exome if new genes have come up, and you can use this information again later on. So therefore, exome sequencing would be the right way to do. And then if you find a genetic defect, then you can counsel the patient in the right way.
I think that is a very important point you just mentioned, that if I'm doing some genetic testing today and I get a negative result, that does not necessarily mean that I shouldn't ask for genetic testing a couple of years later, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And in particular, since also, I mean, it's not only the exome itself that can be used again, but there is also new technologies that are coming. Yeah, so the non-coding regions that are covered by genome sequencing are now coming into play more and more. Yeah, so there are, for example, complex repeat sequences that are changed, yeah, and that you don't get with exome sequencing. So this is one of the examples that has come up in recent years, and it will probably gain more importance in the next years.
Holger, could you give us a practical example why a positive genetic finding might be relevant for the prognosis and the therapy of a given patient?
Yes. So a very prominent example are the sodium channelopathies. Yeah, so Dravet syndrome was the first sodium channelopathies. It's a typical syndrome with a loss of function, caused by a loss of function of sodium channels. And when you apply sodium channel blockers in these patients, you usually don't have a therapeutic effect, or you can even reach deterioration. So you should not give sodium channel blockers in these patients. In the meantime, we have seen that this is the same in SCN2A and SCN8A. In 2A and 8A, we have two entities each. So we have people with gain of function and people with loss of function. And the gain of function mutations have an earlier onset, are often more severe, yeah, and have a little bit a different clinical picture. I don't have the time to go into the details now, but we can differentiate them clinically. And the one group with a gain of function, so too much sodium is flowing into the cells through these channels, and you can block this with sodium channel blockers. And we have seen that they have an interesting response and better response to sodium channel blockers as those with a loss of function. Yeah, and interestingly, also in SCN1A, now it has been shown that there is also a disease caused by gain of function, which is different from Dravet syndrome, yeah, which goes along with severe bone deformation and earlier onset and a more severe epileptic encephalopathy. So this gain loss of function ion channels plays an important role. Yeah, and we also have examples from potassium channels, for example, where we know that drugs that are not known as anti-epileptic drugs can be used to ameliorate the epilepsy and also the development of these patients. So also cognition, gait, ataxia, which are often seen in these patients, can be ameliorated.
Oh, that's amazing. Very interesting. Can you give us an example of such a drug that is not known as an anti-seizure medication?
Yeah, it's 4-aminopyridine. This is a drug that we know from therapy, antispastic therapy in multiple sclerosis or gait problems. And some of you might also know it as a drug that has been given in episodic ataxia, so another form of genetic ataxia. And interestingly, it's used in animal models or slice models or whatever to induce epileptic activity. So if you give a lot of this substance, you can also cause epileptic seizures. And nevertheless, there are gain-of-function mutations in specific types of potassium channels that react specifically to this 4-aminopyridine. They have a gain-of-function, and you can give this drug without causing seizures, or only very rarely. We observed this, and we treated 11 patients altogether, and the youngest ones really responded best and had this amelioration in cognition, in speech, in gait, and also in seizures that I just reported.
Is that a general rule? The earlier, the better?
I think so, yes. And I think this makes it, it's a little bit too early to generalize this, but it makes a lot of sense from a pathophysiological point of view, because these younger children have less developmental problems at that time when you start the therapy. And when you start this in an adult, of course, all the wiring and connections in the brain are already at a much more developed state, and probably it's much more difficult to reverse anything. And that's what's the experience with these patients as well.
Okay, coming back to the level of the general neurologist who addressed an exome sequencing and he gets a positive finding and a positive result. What's the next step? Does the whole family has been to seek some advice? Do we have to include genetic experts in addition to the neurologist?
Okay, so it depends a little bit if the neurologist is familiar with such diseases, if he can interpret this. Yeah, so if he knows about loss, gain, or function, has read about this. But in principle, every neurologist who knows what to do can do this kind of treatment, yeah, and also specific treatment. But of course, we are happy to give advice. Yeah, so we have even some funding for this that in a German network for rare diseases that we have physicians available that are able to give recommendations in these cases and also to look specifically which mutations, because often the geneticists don't tell this and it's not known. Now you have a variant in the sodium channel, you get this back from the geneticist, you don't know, is it gain or loss of function? Yeah, and also we have to look in the literature and there are some tools now available that can give us hints, particularly if these variants have been already investigated physiologically in a specific system. So that would be one part. And the other part, of course, it would make sense to have a geneticist, in particular if there are questions about family planning, because then genetic counseling becomes an important step. Yeah, so if their children are young and maybe not 15 years old, because then I suspect that a second child is maybe already underway or has been planned before. But so if these are young children and the parents would like to know what's the chance to get a second healthy child, then we can tell them that this is a de novo mutation. If this has been looked at, so if the parents don't carry the mutation, then the chances that the second child gets the disease is only little increased compared to the normal population. And this is, of course, a very important information and a relief for the parents that they should try this.
It's a difficult question. Could you give me an estimate in how many of our epilepsy patients nowadays it is mandatory to do genetic testing?
Well, this type of, I would say in all these severe epilepsies, and let's come back to diagnostics because we don't have therapies for all these epilepsies. Yeah? So the majority we cannot treat adequately and we just have to do trial and error as in all epilepsies. But if you look at the importance of diagnosis, then I think they should get it all, because then you know what's happening. You don't have to do all these metabolic testing that we have done in the past, yeah, and cycles of MRIs and what else to find the etiology of that type of epilepsy. And now you can just make the genetic test and know about the diagnosis. And if it's unclear, of course, you need to do it in addition, but I think it's really worthwhile to do it in these patients. Yeah, for all the others, it's a question. You can do it, but you don't have to do it. Yeah, and for example, in familial benign syndromes, I think it makes sense. Yeah, that people know I have it. I could give it to the next generation. My parents, my children could get it. But it might also be a question of the patient himself if he or she would like to know it or not. Yeah, so. This would be more Ken cases.
All right. So, Holger, the last aspect I want to discuss with you today is a very fascinating aspect, I believe, because I think we are approaching something like precision medicine here. And I know, but you know much better, of course, than I do about some perspectives that are already in a realistic pipeline, investigational approaches, new drug ideas. Can you tell us something about that? That would be fascinating.
This is a fascinating topic. So far I brought examples that we can use today with medications that are available. But there are new medications that are made by drug companies that are much more specific than those that we have. Yeah? So there is an NaV1.6 specific sodium channel blocker that only works on one of the sodium channels and that has, as far as I knew, as I've heard, a fascinating profile with side effects. And these drugs can be specifically used to, for example, treat patients with a gain of function NaV1.6 mutation, but also, interestingly, to treat Dravet patients, because if you combine this kind of reduction of NaV1.6 and reduction of NaV1.1, then you can also treat the disease. So these specific drugs are very interesting. There also exist attempts to do that for calcium channels, for example. I'm in contact with one company that is doing this against the calcium channel disease. So there is much hope that this is very promising, and that these specific drugs are better than the drugs that we have today. And the second thing is, of course, gene therapy. So there are clinical trials already running where you can manipulate genes with short sequences of that interact with RNA, the so-called antisense oligonucleotides. The short name is ASO, A-S-O. And they can be applied intrathecally, injections by lumbar spine puncture. And so we hope that this will be the next step in therapy. There, as I said, clinical trials already running. We hope that not only the epileptic seizures, but also the development can be severely altered and changed with these new drugs.
Oh, thank you. That is really great to hear. And I think it is apparent that this topic is something that should be repeated again and again and again in the weekly neurology series and in other podcasts, because it is so fascinating and growing and challenging in any way. So thank you very, very much to give us this perfect insight into this topic of our episode today, and I wish you all the fortune you need for the new perspectives we all need in the treatment of and diagnostics, of course, of our epilepsy patients. So thanks again to you, Holger, and to the audience of today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. And have a good day. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Thank you.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.